and he made a goblin appear. Lots of kids got scared and screamed. Not me. Well, maybe me a little. If he does that again, I'm not gonna scream. Put your boots on. Let's go get breakfast. Wow, you move slow in the morning. Is that 'cause you're so old?
Breakfast was served at two long tables in the basement. The fare was scrambled eggs, potatoes, and thick slices of fried bread. The head cook was a 13-year-old girl who was assisted by an army of younger children, all of whom seemed to take their jobs very seriously. The talk at the tables was about the party that night and what life was going to be like after the separation.
"So if the magic world is invisible," asked a small boy whose hair stuck out in all directions, "does that mean we're going to be invisible too?"
"No, dummy," replied Abigail. "Just like certain streets and stuff are going to be invisible.
And are people really going to forget there's such things as wizards and dragons?"
asked a girl further down the table.
"They ain't going to forget. They're just not going to think they're real."
"So, if I'm invisible?"
asked the small boy again.
"You ain't gonna be invisible," Abigail insisted.
"Maybe his brain's gonna be invisible," shouted another boy.
"Yeah, it's invisible already," added a third.
"He's not,"
said the small boy, though he looked somewhat concerned and even reached up to touch his head. Kate listened, but didn't join in. She was thinking about how she'd woken in the middle of the night to find the church silent and dark, and Abigail, having snuck into her bed, curled up against her. Kate had put her arm around the girl, as she'd put her arm around Emma countless times, and she had been about to drift back to sleep when she'd noticed a shadow moving among the children. She'd realized it was Rafe, whom she had not seen since her interview with Henrietta Burke in the tower. He was going from bed to bed, touching a shoulder or a head, whispering to this or that child, letting them know he was there. Suddenly there was a great banging of pots and pans, and Kate looked up from her reverie to see Jake and Beatles standing on a bench and calling for attention. Over the shouts of the other children, the two boys announced that they were on a special mission from Rafe. A mission, they took care to point out, that Rafe had not felt comfortable entrusting to the intelligence of anyone else. This occasioned much groaning and cries of, "Yeah, yeah, go on," and, "You mean he couldn't find anyone else stupid enough to do it?" and a few lobbed pieces of bread, which Beatles expertly caught and stuffed in his mouth.
"And we are here," Beatles mumbled through the bread, "to read out the various duties that you scrubs will have to accomplish to get ready for the party."
This was greeted by cheers, at which both boys bowed, followed by more thrown bread and cries of,
"Read it! Go on, read it!"
And they proceeded to read a list of names and chores and who was responsible for what.
"And you gotta do it double quick,"
Beetle said, swallowing the last of his bread.
"Yeah,"
Jake said.
"So if any of you were thinking of sitting here and opening a shop..."
After breakfast, Kate went upstairs to get her coat. She'd promised to help Abigail with her errands, and she turned down the long hall that led to the main body of the church, when something lunged out of the shadows and grabbed her arm.
"Why are you here?"
demanded a raspy voice. It was the old magician, Scruggs. He was wrapped in his tattered brown cloak and was still wild-eyed and unwashed. Kate sensed that he'd been waiting for her.
"I'm going to get my coat."
"No, here."
His grip, already tight on her arm, became even tighter.
"Why did you make the Atlas bring you here?"
Kate felt a chill that had nothing to do with the cold.
"You know?"
The old man grinned.
"That you're the keeper of the Atlas? Of course I know. It's written on your face, at least for those with eyes to see. You're here
for the boy, aren't you?
I don't know what you're talking about. What boy? He shook her arm, hissing.
You're here for the boy. You're here for Reef.
What? No, I came here by accident. I just want to get home. She tried to twist free her arm, but the man was too strong.
You're telling the truth.
He seemed almost surprised.
So, it wasn't you at all. It was the Atlas.
And he murmured,
deep, very deep.
What are you talking about? Kate demanded. The man leaned closer.
You think it was chance you came here to this time, to this place? It wasn't you. Yes, I see that. It was the Atlas. It has plans. Him I've known about for years. Tried to tell Henrietta. She wouldn't listen. But now you arrive. Things are finally becoming clear. Yes. And, of course, it would happen now, with a separation upon us.
What are you talking about? Who is Rafe?
Tell me.
The old man leaned even closer.
Are you here to save us, or to destroy us?
Mastering her voice, Kate said, I just want to go home. The sound of a violin drifted down the hall. Kate went rigid.
What is it, girl? Don't like the music?
Kate didn't respond. The last time she'd heard a violin had been aboard the Countess's boat, when it had heralded the arrival of the dire Magnus. But that song had been manic, feverish, otherworldly. This tune was nothing like that. It was a slow, mournful song, and very real. It was coming from a room at the end of the hall. The old man gave a snort.
We'll see what happens, won't we? We'll see. We'll see.
He released her arm and shuffled off down the hall. Kate waited there a moment longer, the music moving through her, unsettling her. Then she turned and hurried away. Outside it was still snowing. More than a foot had fallen during the night, though most of the snow had been tramped down and pushed to the edges of the sidewalk. Kate's breath plumed before her, and she burrowed her hands deep into the pockets of her coat. Abigail did not seem bothered by the cold. She carried 4 or 5 empty canvas bags over her arm and was repeating aloud the things they had to get. They had just started off when there were cries of, Hey! Wait! And Jake and Beatles came huffing up.
We're coming with you, Beatles said.
Did Rafe tell you to watch me? Kate asked, sounding as annoyed as she felt. The boys looked at each other, then at her.
No.
Uh-huh. You two are terrible liars.
Well, Beatles said, maybe he did, and maybe he didn't, but we ain't gonna tell, not even if you torture us.
Yeah, Jake said. You can chop off our heads, cook 'em, eat 'em. We still won't tell you.
That's right, said his friend. Ah!
Oh, come on, Kate said. It turned out to be fun having the boys along, and the 4 of them spent the morning going around the city from store to store, taking care of the items on Abigail's list. Their first stop was a cheese shop, where Abigail bought 2 medium-sized blocks of cheese, ignoring the boys' pleas to buy the massive wheel of cheese in the window, which was larger than any of them and would have had to be rolled back to the church like a wagon wheel.
Boys,
Abigail muttered to Kate,
that's why I keep the money.
After that, they went to the pasty shop and ordered 5 dozen pasties of different sorts, ham and cheese, potato and herbs, cheese and potato and mushroom, and, after a great deal of begging, with Jake and Beatles finally agreeing to do all of Abigail's chores for a week, she bought them each a sausage and onion and cheese pasty.
I would have gotten them pasties anyway,
Abigail confessed to Kate as they walked through the falling snow, eating their hot turnovers, with the boys before them, each extolling the virtues of his own pasty, while peering into the others, and pronouncing with great regret that his friend had been tricked, and his pasty was filled with chopped-up rat butts. And they went to a chocolate shop, and the smell of the cooking chocolate made the air seem itself like a delicacy, and Abigail bought 5 pounds of chocolate to use for cocoa. The owner was a jovial fat man who gave the children steaming mugs of hot chocolate, and they sat on oak barrels in front of his store, watching the snow fall past the window, the men and women hurrying by with their bundles and packages, the horse-drawn carriages clopping along the street, tossing up clumps of greyish-white slush. And they went to a pie shop, where Abigail placed an excitingly long and complicated order, which they would return for later that afternoon. And then it was on to a shop that sold varieties of cider, and the boys bemoaned the fact that they hadn't been given the job of going to the sweet shop or the firework shop, as everyone knew they were the two best.
"Pshaw," Abigail sniffed. "You'd be glad you got what you got by coming with us. Left to yourselves, you'd be peeling potatoes all day."
By noon, Abigail's bags were stuffed to bursting and divided among them, and the boys were complaining that their feet hurt and they were hungry, and Abigail said that they had one more stop down in Chinatown, and they would get lunch there. And as she said it, the boys looked at her, exclaiming,
"Wait, you're getting firework makings for Scruggs, ain't you?"
And Abigail smiled and said,
"Rafe gave me special orders before I left."
And the boys whooped and led the way. As they came into Chinatown, they found the streets packed with noodle stands inside canvas lean-tos, small vendors selling massive twisted roots of various colours, jars with dried and blackened leaves. One vendor, who seemed to be selling nothing but teeth, ranging from the impossibly tiny to a yellow canine as large as Kate's arm. Men and women bustled past in padded jackets, the men with long, tightly braided pigtails hanging down their backs. Everywhere Kate looked, there was something interesting to see, and she wished Michael and Emma were there with her.
"Hey!" Beetle shouted. "There's Rafe! Hey, Rafe!"
Kate saw the older boy at the edge of a vendor's stall 20 yards away. He seemed like he'd been caught out and was even then contemplating slipping away, but then he changed his mind and turned to face them.
"What are you doing here, Rafe?"
Jake asked.
"You're getting stuff for the party."
And Kate thought, he was waiting here for me.
"We came down to get fireworks like you told me," Abigail said. "But we were going to get lunch first, 'cause these two are belly-aching."
"We're not,"
Jake said.
"Yeah,"
Beetle said.
"We were worried about you fainting, is all."
Abigail just laughed.
"Ha!"
"Go to Fong's around the corner," Rafe said.
"It's the best place in Chinatown."
"Yeah, sure,"
Beetle said.
"Fong's, we know that place. Got a green door."
"A red door,"
Rafe said.
"Oh, yeah,"
Beetle said.
"They must have changed it."
Then Rafe, looking at Kate, said, "You all go on. She'll catch up." The children hurried away, and Kate and the boy were left standing there. She saw snowflakes were melting on his hair and shoulders, and there were dark circles under his eyes. She wondered how much he'd slept the night before, or if he'd slept.
"Those are the clothes Abigail gave you?"
he asked. Kate looked down, feeling suddenly self-conscious in her shabby wool pants and old boots, the patched shirts and jackets.
"Yes, what's wrong with them?"
"Nothing. I should have looked at you before you left the church. Where's your cap?"
Kate pulled it out of her pocket.
"I didn't need it. My head wasn't cold."
"It ain't just to keep you warm. Put it on."
Kate twisted up her hair and pulled the cloth cap low over her eyes. The boy reached toward her face, and she flinched back.
"Hold still."
He tucked a couple of loose strands of blonde hair into her cap, and she felt his fingers brush the tops of her ears.
"All right, let me see your hands."
She held them out, and he took them, turning them over. She saw how clean and white her hands were compared to his. There was a small coal fire burning in front of the stand they'd stopped beside, and he bent and gathered soot and ash from the fire and rubbed the warm black powder over her palms and fingers and the backs of her hands. Then he reached up. Kate held still this time, though to her annoyance the trembling in her chest had returned, and brushed his fingers over her cheeks and forehead. She stared at his face as he did so, the deep-set green eyes, the slightly crooked nose, and she noticed how carefully he avoided her gaze. She had the strange sense that he was as nervous as she. He stepped back, clapping off the excess soot on the legs of his pants.
There! You could walk past an imp now, and he wouldn't know you.
Thank you, Kate said, her voice fainter than she would have liked.
So, what's this, then?
It took Kate a moment to understand what he was holding, and by the time she realized that he had her mother's locket, that he must have taken it from her pocket while he'd been checking her wardrobe, Rafe had snapped it open and was looking at the decade-old picture of her and Michael and Emma. "Give that back!" Kate snatched the locket from his hand and clutched it tight in her fist.
"I wasn't going to steal it," the boy said. "But you should get a chain instead of keeping it in your pocket. You'll lose it that way."
"I had a chain," Kate said angrily. "I traded it for this coat."
"Yeah. Well, if it was gold like that locket, you got robbed."
"And you would know all about robbing someone, wouldn't you?" Her face was hot, the nervousness gone.
"So who are they, in the picture?"
Kate stared at him, weighing whether or not to respond.
"My brother and sister," she said finally.
"The picture's 10 years old. They're the reason I need to get back."
"What about your parents? Where are they?"
Kate said nothing, and the boy seemed to understand. They stood in silence for several seconds, then Kate said,
"So, is that it? I'm hungry."
She started to walk away, but Rafe placed a hand on her arm.
"I'll show you the place."
He turned down a narrow street and led her to a flight of stairs, at the top of which was a red door marked with a symbol Kate couldn't read.
"That's it, there."
Kate started up the stairs, not intending to say goodbye, when the boy said,
"I shouldn't have taken your locket. I'm sorry."
Kate stopped. She was 2 steps above him. She knew for certain then that he had come to Chinatown to find her, and that he was indeed sorry. She thought again of her encounter with Scruggs that morning, and heard herself say,
"Why don't you come in?"
He shook his head.
"I ain't hungry."
"But you haven't eaten, have you? I mean, I hear this is the best place in Chinatown."
He looked at her a moment longer, then nodded and stepped up past her and opened the door. A pair of rugs hung from the ceiling a couple of feet inside the restaurant, providing a buffer against the cold, and Rafe waited there till Kate had closed the door behind her. For a moment, the two of them were standing close and facing each other in the small space. Then Rafe pushed through the rugs, and they stepped into the restaurant. It was loud, crowded, and smoky, and the air was heavy with the smell of cooking oil, onions, and ginger. There were long tables with benches, all of which were full, and there was a counter at the back for more diners, and behind the counter, at least a dozen cooks were taking orders and shouting while passing bowl after steaming bowl out into the waiting hands of the crowd. There were several groups of dwarves scattered among the tables, but most of the diners were Chinese men, all of whom, it seemed, to Kate, were speaking at once, and everyone was packed in so tight and close that Kate felt herself retreating from the press of bodies.
"There they are,"
Rafe said, pointing to where Jake and Beatles and Abigail were stuffed together at a table and waving.
"There's no room," Kate said.
"We'll sit at the bar."
And he took her hand and led her through the throng and found space at the counter. They were crammed in tight, shoulders, elbows, and hips pressed against the diners on either side and against each other. There was a short wall separating the counter from the cook's area, and Kate watched the young Chinese man dice an onion with such blurring speed that she was sure several fingers would end up in someone's soup. Rafe spoke to the cook, and, a moment later, two steaming bowls of honey-coloured noodles landed before them. The noodles were served in a milky broth, and she could see, but not identify, various vegetables and herbs floating among hunks of egg and chicken. Rafe handed her a set of chopsticks, and she watched how the boy balanced his own between his fingers and the crook of his thumb. He saw her staring.
"They don't have these where you're from."
"We have chopsticks. I've just never used them, especially not with soup." He grinned. It was the first time he'd truly smiled at her.
"It kind of involves a lot of slurping."
He demonstrated, shoveling a wad of noodles into his mouth and then sort of vacuuming up the tail ends. The noise it made was tremendous, and only covered by the fact that everyone around them was doing the exact same thing.
"I guess manners are a modern invention," Kate said with a smile. "Try it."
Realizing that she was starving and that she hadn't eaten anything since her pasty with Abigail hours before, Kate applied herself to the bowl. The noodles were thick and squishy, and it took her four tries to get one that didn't immediately slip out of the chopsticks, and even then she bent close to the bowl, fearful that if she brought the noodle higher, she would lose it. The noodle slapped the side of her cheek as she slurped it up.
"Well?"
She turned to him, a stunned look on her face.
"That's amazing."
"Told you." And he grinned again. For a while, Kate forgot everything but her noodles and was slurping away as loudly as anyone in the restaurant. When she glanced over and saw Rafe lifting his bowl and drinking the broth, she did the same, and after that she got braver and began lifting the noodles high, sometimes with a piece of egg or chicken, and lowering the whole delicious mess into her mouth. And as crowded and loud and smoky as the restaurant was, and though she was constantly being bumped and jostled, or feeling cold air against her neck when someone pushed through the rugs by the door, somehow it was all wonderful. It was as if Kate had managed to leave outside everything she carried with her on a daily basis. Her thoughts of her parents, the need to find them, her constant worry about her brother and sister. Sitting there, wedged at the counter, she was, however briefly, just a girl in a strange, exciting place with a boy her own age.
"So, you're really from the future?"
"Yes."
"And the separation, it works? People forget that magic is real?"
Kate nodded.
"Everyone thinks, I used to think, it's just from fairy tales."
The boy idly stirred the remains of his soup with his chopsticks.
"Well, maybe Miss B's right then, though I still don't see why we should be the ones hiding."
Kate stared at him. An uneasy feeling began to stir inside her.
"Not all normal humans hate magical people. You can't judge everyone that way."
The boy turned on her. The intensity in his green eyes was like nothing Kate had ever seen. It required effort not to look away.
"Course they hate us. What do you think happened to Miss B's arm? Who do you think did that?"
"But it doesn't make sense. You're human too. You're no different. Just you can do magic."
The boy laughed. But there was no humor in it.
"You don't think that's enough? They hate us 'cause we can do things they can't. Makes them jealous and afraid."
The boy began flexing one of the chopsticks between his fingers.
"There've been riots in other cities. Mobs burning down magic quarters, chasing folk out, killing them. That's the whole point of the separation, a way to protect ourselves. Then, even if we're still living among them, they won't know it. I guess it's the right thing."
The chopsticks snapped, and he laid the pieces down. Neither spoke for a moment. Then Kate said,
"Was that you playing the violin this morning?"
The boy looked at her.
"I was in the hall," she said. "I couldn't help but hear."
Rafe nodded.
"It was something my mother taught me, from her old village.
She always had me play it to her, said it reminded her of home.
Oh, is she? She's dead. I'm sorry.
They were both silent again, which seemed fine, as the restaurant was so loud around them.
Hey, you guys done yet?
Beatles and Jake were behind them.
Abigail's outside already, Jake said. She says we gotta hurry and get the rest of the stuff. She's kind of bossy.
I'll be right there, Kate said.
The boys hurried out through the crowd. Kate looked at Rafe.
Thank you for lunch.
Rafe nodded and then, abruptly, as if he'd made up his mind and feared that if he hesitated he might not follow through, he reached into his jacket and pulled out a small, fat purse.
Here, take it.
Kate glanced at the purse, then at him. The boy wasn't looking at her.
What is it?
Money. Enough to get you to that place up north, or wherever.
I don't understand. Miss Burke said it would be a few days.
This has got nothing to do with Miss B.
I don't understand.
There's nothing to understand.
The boy was keeping his voice low, but he was getting frustrated, and when he looked at her, Kate saw something like desperation in his eyes.
I'm telling you to go. I'm asking you.
But why are you doing this now? Now, all of a sudden?
I got my reasons. Just take it, all right?
He grabbed her hand and curled her fingers around the purse. Kate felt utterly confused. On some level, she sensed that the boy was trying to protect her, but she also knew there was much he wasn't saying.
And you won't tell me why?
I can't.
Or how you know me, because I know you do. There's no point in lying.
The boy said nothing. Kate pulled her hand away from his. She felt the heaviness of the purse, the shapes of the coins under the old leather. She could go up to Cambridge Falls, find a way back home, be reunited with her brother and sister, but then she would never learn the boy's secret. And she thought of what Scruggs had said, that the Atlas had brought her here for a reason. Was it possible that this boy was the reason? If so, who was he? She set the purse on the bar.
Then I'm staying.
And she walked out. Abigail and the boys were in high spirits after lunch. They went to the firework maker, picked up Scruggs's order, and then headed back toward the church, laden with their purchases. Kate glanced behind them several times, but could not see Rafe following. She felt deeply confused. And then something happened that confused things even more. They were walking down a narrow cross street, and as they passed a small house, they saw a dwarf couple. It was the first time Kate had ever seen a female dwarf. Mostly, she looked just like a male dwarf without the beard, carrying out furniture to load into a donkey cart.
"See that?" Jake said. "They're getting out before the separation, probably going to one of them big places upstate. What they calling them? Reserves?" "Once the separation happens,"
Beatles explained to Kate,
"there are gonna be a few streets downtown that are only for magic folk. Normal humans won't even know they're there. But dwarves and gnomes and stuff, all them that can't pass for human or that can't afford glamours to disguise themselves, lots of them are getting out of the city for good."
Suddenly, something struck the dwarf in the head, exploding all over his face and shoulders. It was a snowball, Kate realized, and then another struck the dwarf's wife, hitting her square in the back. A few more snowballs smashed against the cart. Kate saw three surly-looking teenagers across the street, packing snowballs and jeering.
"Go on! Get out of here! We don't want you!"
They threw another volley of snowballs, striking both dwarves and knocking a small figurine off the pile of goods in the cart. The figurine hit the curb and shattered. Kate started forward, furious, not sure what she was going to do, certain only that she was going to do something, when Abigail grabbed her arm and pulled her back.
"Let me go! Don't you see what they're doing?"
"Better not make trouble," Abigail said quietly. "Rafe says we're supposed to keep clear when things turn bad. They're okay, see?"
Leaving the pieces of the figurine on the sidewalk,
The dwarf and his wife had climbed into their cart and were driving down the street, pursued by the taunts and snowballs of the teenagers.
"Come on,"
Abigail said, and pulled Kate away. Kate was deeply troubled by the incident. So was everything Rafe had told her true? The teenagers seemed to hate the dwarves for no reason but that they were different. She felt sick to her stomach.
"So it's really always like this?"
Abigail laughed.
"That ain't nothing." "It's worse."
"Worse?
You heard what happened to Rafe's ma?"
"What are you talking about? She's dead."
"Yeah, and how'd she die? Some human without a drop of magic in him killed her."
"What?" Kate stopped in her tracks.
"No one talks about it, but we all know. Why you think Rafe hates them so much? And he's going to be real powerful some day. I heard Scruggs telling Miss B."
Kate grabbed the girl's arm and wrenched her around.
"What did you hear? Tell me."
Abigail seemed surprised at Kate's vehemence.
"Nothing, really. Just I'd gone up to the belfry. They didn't know I was there, see? And I heard them talking about Rafe."
"And what did Scruggs say?"
"Please, Abigail, this is important. Just what I told you, that Rafe is gonna be a real powerful wizard. Why?"
Kate had no answer. All she had was her deep conviction that Rafe was connected to her, and not just to her, but to Michael and Emma, to the search for the books. But how? And was he their friend or enemy? She needed to know. Just then there was a pounding of feet, and they turned to see Beatles and Jake running toward them, red-faced and grinning.
"We gotta go,"
Beatles said.
"Why?"
Kate said. "What happened?"
"Remember how we weren't supposed to do nothing?"
Jake said.
"Well, we didn't do that."
"We flew some snowballs,"
Beatles explained.
"We didn't think there'd be magic or nothing, but after we threw them, the snowballs started changing colours on their own and getting all goopy, and..."
"There they are!"
The cry had come from down the block, and Kate turned and saw the three thuggish teenagers led by a tall, angry, pinch-faced youth who looked to be covered in a greenish sludge, sprinting toward them.
"Get the freaks!"
"Run!"
Kate cried. The children needed no encouragement. They bolted down the street, the teenagers hard behind them, howling with fury.
"Can't you do something?"
Kate panted.
"Some magic?"
"You gotta be calm to do magic," Beetle said. "It don't work if you're scared."
And he added,
"Not that I'm scared."
"Me neither,"
Jake said. Kate's mind was racing. She knew they couldn't outrun the teenagers, but then she saw, past the end of the block, an avenue crowded with pedestrians, carriages, carts. On a packed street, there would be places to hide. That would work, she knew, as long as someone led their pursuers away.
"Listen, when we turn the corner, you three are going to hide. I'll make them follow me."
"Uh-uh,"
Jake said.
"Rafe said we're supposed to watch out for you."
"Stupid,"
Beetle said.
"You're not supposed to tell her that."
"There's no time to argue. You look after Abigail. I'll meet you back at the church."
"I don't need anyone looking—"
Abigail began, but they were already rounding the corner, and Kate spied a set of steps leading to a basement below a grocer's. She pushed the children toward it.
"There! Go, now!"
Jake and Beatles grabbed Abigail and dragged her down the stairs and out of sight. Kate leaped into the midst of traffic. She heard cursing and the neighing of horses, the sound of reins being snapped tight, but she ploughed ahead, her feet sliding in the slush, looking neither left nor right, till she reached the far sidewalk. Once there, she turned. The three teenagers had reached the corner and were searching for their quarry.
"Hey, here I am! Come, catch me!"
she taunted. Shouting with rage, they charged after her. "That's right," Kate thought. "Come on!" Then she turned and ran for her life. But she hadn't gone more than 30 yards when she realized the boys were going to catch her. They were too big, too fast, and too angry. She could hear the pounding of their footsteps growing louder and louder. Then she spotted the ladder of a fire escape hanging down. She thought if she could climb up and pull the ladder after her, she could get away. Kate put on a final burst of speed and, 5 yards from the ladder, crashed into a man stepping out of a shop. It was like colliding with a brick wall. Her head snapped back, and her entire body seemed to rebound and slam against the sidewalk. She was dizzy and her vision blurred. Her hat had fallen off, and she had to push back her hair to make out the man standing above her. A mountain of a man in a long fur jacket and fur hat. He hadn't moved.
"You're all right there, lass. You should be looking where you're going, running pell-mell like that through the streets."
She heard the boys skidding to a halt behind her. She looked back, still too unsteady to get to her feet, and saw the tall, pinch-faced boy, backed on either side by his thuggish friends, pointing his finger at the man in the fur coat.
"Get away from her! She's ours!"
Kate knew she had to run, but she also knew if she stood now, she'd just fall over.
"And what would you be wanting with a sweet, innocent girl like this?" the man asked. "Sure she's done nothing wrong. Face of an angel she has.
She's a freak. She—"
And Kate, who was still looking at the boys, watched as their expressions changed. Something they'd seen had given them pause.
"What's that you're saying about freaks?" the man asked.
The tall boy looked angrier than ever.
"You'll get yours too one day, all of you."
"Begone!" the man said, "before I find myself losing patience."
The tall boy spat on the ground. Then they all three sulked off. Feeling steadier, Kate slowly stood and turned to thank the man. She froze. He was flanked on either side by bowler-hatted imps, their small eyes fixed upon her.
"It's her,"
one of the creatures said.
"I remember."
"Sure, isn't it herself?" the man purred. "Can't I see it written on her face?"
He placed a large hand on Kate's arm.
"Would you mind coming with us for a wee bit? There's someone who would very much like to speak with you. Oh, but where are me manners?"
He removed his fur hat, revealing the great bald stone of his head.
"The name is Rourke."
Chapter 12. To the Fortress. Twice Gabriel lifted Michael to his feet, and twice the boy's knees buckled, and he crumpled to the ground.
"If you fall again," Gabriel said, pulling him up once more, "I will have to leave you here."
"That thing took Emma."
"I know."
"But it took her."
"Yes, and I cannot both pursue it and carry you, so either stand or you will be left behind."
They were in the clearing. Emma and the creature had disappeared moments before. In the starlight, Michael could see the thick vein of Gabriel's scar pulsing on the side of his jaw. Michael knew that Gabriel was restraining himself from going after Emma alone. He knew he needed to pull himself together. Gabriel released his shoulders, and Michael swayed, but kept his balance.
"That thing," Michael said. "Did you see?"
"Yes."
"And was it was it actually—"
"Yes."
It seemed that neither man nor boy wanted to name the creature aloud. But for Michael, it was enough that Gabriel had seen what he had, the great leathery bat-like wings, the long serpent's body, the jagged line of spines ridged along the creature's back, the enormous talons that had snatched Emma off the ground. He hadn't imagined it. His sister had been taken by a dragon. And for a second he felt so weak and lost that he was sure he would topple over and be left there by Gabriel.
"What are we going to do?"
"We will find your sister and kill the beast that took her."
"But what if she's already—"
Gabriel lunged, seizing a handful of Michael's shirt. His face was cloaked in shadow, his voice a growl.
"She is alive. She is alive, and we will find her. Now, come!"
and he sprinted away across the clearing, with Michael staggering along behind. Michael lost track of time. Half an hour, Gabriel kept disappearing into the darkness, leaving Michael to carve his own path through the thicket of ferns that blanketed the forest floor. Again and again, just when Michael was convinced that Gabriel had finally abandoned him, the man would appear from behind a tree, hissing, "This way! Faster!" And Michael would push himself on as the ferns beat at his arms and face, and the same refrain played over and over in his head. "You lost Kate, and now you lost Emma. You lost Kate, and now you lost Emma. You lost Emma. You lost Emma." Then, abruptly, the trees and ferns ended, and Michael stepped out onto a rocky plain and found Gabriel waiting. Free of the weight of the forest, Michael felt the immense openness of the night sky, and he took a deep, relieved breath.
"There, you see?"
Gabriel was pointing up the valley to where the volcano rose from the plain, a quarter of a mile distant. It had not occurred to Michael what direction they were heading in, and he stared now in wonder. The volcano took up almost the entire width of the plain, a perfect pyramid rising nearly to the height of the canyon walls. Looking up, Michael could see an ominous red glow emanating from the cone. Unbidden, the memories he'd acquired in Malpessa came surging up, and he had again the feeling of déjà vu. The chronicle was close.
"You see it?"
Gabriel asked. Michael realized that Gabriel was pointing to a spot about a third of the way up the volcano's slope, where a light flickered in the dark. Squinting, Michael could just discern the outline of a large structure. The dead man's memories filled in the rest.
"It's the Order's fortress," he said. "This is where they brought the book." "What I care about," Gabriel said, "is finding your sister."
And they set off once more. The lower slope of the volcano was a jumble of giant black rocks, and Michael had to clamber upward on all fours as Gabriel strode ahead. Soon the boulders gave way to small rocks and scree, and for every two steps Michael slid back one. Still, he kept on. By now the fortress was in sharp relief, and Michael could make out 30-foot-high walls of black stone, ramparts and battlements where a defender might take position. He could see nothing of the buildings inside the walls, save a lone tower that rose into the sky, at the crown of which a fire blazed forth. It was an impressive, imposing structure, but Michael couldn't help but question the wisdom of building on the side of a volcano.
"I mean," he muttered, panting his way up the slope, "they do blow up after all."
Gabriel was standing before the fortress gates, a pair of heavy wooden doors the height of the walls, and Michael arrived, trembling and out of breath.
"Sorry, I'm actually in excellent shape. Must be the altitude."
"Look."
Gabriel gestured to the three interlocking circles carved into the door. The fortress, the whole valley, was still and silent. Michael whispered,
"Do you think they know we're here?"
Gabriel picked up a large rock and hammered, thud, 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 till the doors swung open. He dropped the rock.
"Yes."
With Gabriel leading, they passed into a courtyard of packed earth. Michael waited, and when no arrows came whistling out of the dark, he relaxed and allowed himself a quick survey. The fortress had been built on a flattened plot, 100 feet wide and perhaps twice that in depth. The central courtyard, where he and Gabriel stood, was dominated by a 2-story stone building with long, narrow windows. The high, flame-topped tower rose from the building's back corner. A wooden skeleton of ladders and catwalks clung to the inside of the fortress walls, providing access to the battlements. Other than that, Michael saw a few ramshackle structures, a small pen for livestock, a blacksmith's forge, several storerooms, and all were dark and empty. Gabriel unsheathed his falchion.
"Stay behind me."
Michael didn't argue. Gabriel kicked open the door of the stone building, and they stepped into a large, high-ceilinged room. Thick-bodied columns ran the length of the chamber, while an eerie red glow, rising from a gap in the floor, pushed back the darkness. The building was a keep, Michael realized, a place to retreat to should the fortress be breached. They advanced slowly to the gap in the center of the floor. It was perhaps 15 feet square, and there were a dozen steps leading down to a heavy iron gate, past which Michael could make out the mouth of a tunnel. The red glow was coming from deep in the volcano, and the heat rose up and stung Michael's eyes. Still, he could feel himself being pulled forward by an invisible force.
"The Chronicle is down there,"
he said quietly.
"Then it is not alone?"
Michael glanced at him, questioning.
"That gate locks from the outside," Gabriel said. "It is not meant to keep us out. It is to keep something in."
He nodded upward, and Michael found himself looking through a large, jagged hole in the keep's ceiling. The hole was directly over the mouth of the tunnel, and Michael imagined that something very big, something, say, dragon-sized, had come roaring out and blasted through the roof of the keep. Except that the gate over the tunnel was down and locked, which meant the dragon had returned home. Michael thought of the creature he'd glimpsed in the clearing, the huge razor-sharp talons, fangs the length of his arm.
"I guess," he said,
trying to sound gruff and ready, and not completely bone-shakingly terrified,
"we should go down there, huh?"
"Yes."
Michael nodded, and suddenly he knew that, scared or not, if going into the tunnel was the way to save Emma, he would do it, though he wondered if he should take a moment to stretch.
"But first," Gabriel said, "we will search the tower."
"What? Why?"
"The dragon did not close that gate. I want to know who did."
He headed for a doorway in the far corner through which a set of stairs could be seen climbing upward. Michael hurried after him, and for a few moments the chamber was still. Then a shadow separated from one of the columns, and a cloaked figure drew a sword and followed.
"Emma!"
Michael ran forward and threw his arms around his sister. He and Gabriel had reached the top of the tower. Climbing the last flight of stairs, Michael had looked up and seen the night sky still brimming with stars, the looming snow-capped mountains, the red and smoking cone of the volcano. He'd seen a fire burning in a brazier on the tower wall. He'd been nervous, not knowing who or what might be waiting in ambush. Then he saw Gabriel stiffen in surprise, and he turned, and there was his own sister, alive and unharmed.
"Oh, Emma!"
He hugged her as if he would never let her go ever again.
"I was so worried. Gabriel, too. We were both really, really worried."
Gabriel said his name, but Michael ignored it.
"Emma!"
he said, holding her arms and stepping away. Now that she was safely back, he felt the need to be the stern older brother.
"I know you've been through an ordeal, but I did ask you to stay out of that clearing. I think there's a lesson here, don't you? Perhaps you should pay more attention when I tell you things."
"Michael!"
"Just a moment, Gabriel. Emma, do you hear me?"
"No, I do not think she does."
"What? What are you—"
Then Michael finally realized that the whole time he'd been hugging her, Emma hadn't once groaned or tried to push him away or made a joke about why didn't he go hug a dwarf.
"Something has frozen her," Gabriel said.
For a moment Michael stared at his motionless sister. Her arms were stiff at her sides and her eyes unblinking. The curled tip of a fern was stuck in her mud-caked hair. As he reached over and plucked it out, he felt the coldness of her skin. Then he said faintly, hopelessly,
"Can you fix her?"
Gabriel shook his head.
"What about Dr. Pym?"
Gabriel hesitated only a fraction of a second, but Michael understood. They had left the wizard fighting for his life in Malpessa. Who could say when they would see him again?
"Never mind," he said. "I know."
Without warning, Gabriel spun around, his falchion hissing through the air. There was a loud metallic clang, and Michael turned to see a cloaked, sword-wielding man stagger back. The man had almond-coloured skin, long, unkempt black hair, and a wild black beard. He was shorter than Gabriel, and very thin. His clothes were ragged and patched, and looked to have been salvaged from a dozen different sources, giving him the appearance of a down-on-his-luck harlequin. Michael's eyes went to the man's tunic, where, stitched into the fabric, were three faded, interlocking circles. Gabriel took a step forward, more to shield Michael than to attack, but the man dropped his sword, threw up his hands, and fell to his knees, crying,
"I yield! Don't kill me! Don't kill poor Bert!"
and promptly burst into tears.
"He's not what I expected," Michael said.
"He has likely been here a long time," Gabriel said. "Perhaps alone. Solitude can have a terrible effect on the mind."
That much, Michael thought, was obvious. The man had finally stopped whimpering and seemed to believe, at least for the time being, that Gabriel and Michael were not going to murder him. He was sitting on the short wall that encircled the tower and consoling himself by munching on a fat black beetle he'd taken from a pocket of his cloak.
"I just expected someone cleaner and not named Bert."
"Do you want to question him, or shall I?"
Gabriel asked. That was clearly the next step. Finding out who the man was he indeed a member of the Order? Was he alone here, or were there others? Was the dragon locked safely inside the volcano? Was it guarding the Chronicle? What was the dragon's connection to the man? Why had it left Emma atop this tower? And, most importantly, what exactly had happened to her, and could it be reversed? Michael looked at his sister. Her mouth was slightly open, as if she'd been on the point of speaking. Her eyes were narrowed, and there was a wrinkle of fury on her brow. Michael saw that her hands down at her sides were clenched into fists. He knew the signs, and was not surprised. His sister had been fighting when she'd been frozen.
"I will."
Emma was his sister, his responsibility.
"Very well. I will be here if you need me, but be quick."
Gabriel gave him a meaningful look.
"Sooner or later, the dragon will return."
Michael conceded that Gabriel had a point. He stepped forward.
"Right. I want to ask you a few questions."
The man had been picking at his teeth with one of the beetle's legs, but now he sat up, running a hand down his beard, and put on an eager-to-please smile. He was crazy, Michael thought, but he appeared to be nice crazy, and not I'll kill you, crazy.
"Happy to talk. Love having visitors. Bert hasn't had any in, well, ever."
He spoke in choppy, heavily accented English.
"Oh, Bert's very sorry about the whole..."
He mimed, hacking at them with an imaginary sword.
"He thought you were elves."
"Yes, well, that's certainly understandable," Michael said. "No one wants elves sneaking about."
As he spoke, Michael was mentally reviewing passages from The Dwarf Omnibus about the art of interrogation. The omnibus, as Michael had often reflected, really did touch on everything. He remembered that G.G. Greenleaf suggested first establishing rapport with your subject. He also said that when the subject's guard was down, the interrogator should whack him in the head with a club. He won't see that coming. Ha! Michael wasn't planning anything quite so violent, but considering how skittish the man was, building rapport seemed like a good initial step. With that in mind, Michael tried to make his tone as chummy as possible.
"So, tell me, friend, you're one of the Order of Guardians, aren't you?"
The man shook his head.
No, Bert's not one of the Order.
But
You've got the symbol on your...
Bert's not one of the Order. He's all of the Order. He's the last there is. Beginning, middle, and end.
He thumped his chest proudly. Michael thought of the silent, deserted fortress and decided the man was telling the truth.
What happened to the others? Gone,
the man said quickly, in a way that told Michael there was more to the story.
Bert's been alone for a very, 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 very long time.
And he popped another beetle in his mouth.
But you're not completely alone. I mean, there's a dragon here.
The man jerked forward, his voice dropping to a whisper.
You've seen the dragon?
Yes, in the forest. Then, as if it were the most casual thing in the world, Michael asked, just out of curiosity, where is the dragon now? The man raised a finger to his lips and pointed toward the volcano, whispering,
Sleeping. Best not to wake.
Michael was taking note of the things he would return to later. The dragon, what had happened to the man's comrades. He decided it was time to come to the key issue. What can you tell me about my sister? The man's eyes widened.
That's your sister? Oh, oh no.
What do you mean, oh no? What's happened to her?
Well, she's frozen, isn't she? Thought that much was fairly obvious. I can see that.
Michael felt his Let's Be Friends mask slip for a second. But what froze her in the first place? Dragons don't freeze people. It's not in any of the literature. The man began nervously braiding his beard.
Well, Bert didn't know she was your sister. Dragon just dumped her in Bert's lap. She was very loud. Lots of threats about how a certain fellow was going to cut off Bert's head. Shouting, shouting, shouting. All these years alone, Bert isn't used to so much yelling. And she kicked Bert in the shin. Hard. Bert will have a bruise tomorrow.
He began rolling up the cuff on his pants. Stop that. What did you do?
Do? Oh, nothing. Much.
Michael gave his best glower. He was honestly rethinking whacking the man in the head. The deranged guardian seemed to get the message. He reached into one of the pockets of his cloak and drew forth a folded patch of cloth.
Bert used to be quite the hand at potions. They taught us magic, the wizards did, long ago.
He unwrapped the cloth and displayed a scorched needle. He began murmuring like someone repeating a recipe.
2 parts dragon's blood, 3 parts deathshade, ground up sloth tongue, not too fine, water from an untouched stream, add salt, heat, then 1 quick prick.
He made a jabbing motion with the needle,
and silence. You drugged her?
The man nodded, then reached into another pocket.
Beetle?
I don't want a beetle. Is she... Michael had to swallow before he could find his voice. Is she alive?
Oh, yes, yes, still alive. But the life has been stopped within her, like a frozen river. Quite a powerful little potion. 1 prick.
He jabbed the air with the needle again.
So, how do we fix her? She's my sister. I'm supposed to be looking out for her.
All of Michael's relaxed rapport-building demeanour was gone. He wanted to grab the man by the beard and shake him.
Can't.
Can't what? Can't tell us? Because my friend here...
Can't fix her. No antidote. At least none Bert has. But she doesn't look that bad. And you could put her somewhere nice. She would really brighten up a room.
My sister is not a piece of furniture.
Of course. Of course,
agreed the man.
But she's not going to be much good for conversation any more. You do realize that, don't you?
I'm going to cut off his head,
Gabriel growled. The man's bottom lip began trembling, and he let out a low moan.
Oh, stop it, Michael snapped. You're supposed to be the last of an ancient order of warriors. Have some dignity.
As the man pulled his cloak over his head in an effort to hide, Michael took a moment to regroup. This wasn't going well. There seemed to be no quick way of restoring Emma, and the more time that passed, the more likely it was that the dragon would wake up, and then what? As much faith as Michael had in Gabriel's strength, a dragon was, after all, a dragon, and he still didn't understand the relationship between the guardian and the dragon. Was the man the creature's master? It didn't appear so, but clearly there was something between them, or the dragon would have killed the man long ago. Michael found that he was unconsciously rubbing the blue-grey orb that hung around his neck. Could the glass marble possibly help? Should he just smash it, as Emma had suggested? What if it had been sent by their enemies? With Emma frozen, smashing the orb seemed too much of a risk. Michael slipped it back inside his shirt. Plan B, Michael thought. We leave now, before the dragon wakes up. Gabriel carries Emma back to the plane. We find Dr. Pym, assuming he's still alive, and he fixes Emma. Then we all come back for the Chronicle. Reviving Emma had to come first. But Michael also knew they couldn't leave without hearing the deranged guardian's story. There was no telling what might help them when they returned for the Chronicle. "I want you to tell us everything. How you came here, what happened to the other guardians, where the dragon came from. Start at the beginning, but be quick."
"And if you lie to us," Gabriel said, "I will most certainly chop off your head."
They had not moved from atop the tower, and as the man spoke, Michael glanced now and then at Emma. Part of him kept expecting her to start laughing and announce that she had been playing a practical joke and wasn't frozen at all. But she stayed just as she was. "Don't worry," he promised silently. "I won't leave you like this."
4,000 years ago, the man began, when the world was a very different place,